Chapter 11. The next morning began with a break in the rain clouds. Only a few immobile strips of cirrus were left crouched over the eastern horizon, fluoresced a pale saffron by the rising sun. According to the channel weathercasts, the next storm front would arrive by tea time. The A47 into Peterborough was even more snarled up than usual. Scooters were in the majority, the city's morning shifts on their way to work, riding up to 4 abreast in the spaces between juggernauts, vans, and company buses. They were used to the traffic, Eleanor wasn't. By the time she reached the section of road which ran alongside the Ferry Meadows estuary, she was shouting at the three riders keeping station 2 meters ahead of their bonnet. The glittery red and blue metallic helmets with their black visors remained unmoved by her diatribe, easily anticipating the surges of the methane-powered van in front of them, braking smoothly. In comparison, she seemed to be hopping forwards like a kangaroo. A steady stream of cyclists zipped by on the inside. Infuriating. 13 years ago, the raised land to the north of the estuary had been a mix of open countryside and pleasant woodland. 12 years ago, it had been swamped by a slum zone of shanty housing, the like of which Europeans had only ever seen in casts from the Third World. Now it was a solid cliff of whitewashed apartment blocks. Long balconies dribbling fronds of colourful vegetation from clay pots, washing hanging on lines between support arches. Solar cell roofs glinted brightly in the morning sun. Below the concrete embankment, the tide was going out, leaving long stains of milk-chocolate mud visible above the sluggish water. A line of artificial stone islands was strung out across the 2 kilometre width of the estuary. The eddy turbine barrage, creating vast, slow-moving whirlpools in each gap. The first time she had ever come to Peterborough, the first time she had ever been to any city, she had accompanied Greg along the same route, visiting the same person. Even 2 years on, the difference was pronounced. More traffic, more people, more urgency, less tolerance. It was all due to Julia. Event Horizon's arrival had tweaked the city's dynamic economy into overdrive. After 10 years of copious growth and financial exuberance, Peterborough still hadn't lost its Frontiersville verve. Everybody was on overtime, chasing impossible directives, and they seemed to thrive on the compulsive achiever atmosphere. My God, is this what regeneration is bringing us back to? Traffic jams and yuppies. At least none of the vehicles was burning petrol. Not even Julia could take that shortcut. Energy generation and supply was becoming a problem again, countrywide. Worldwide, from what the casts said. Solar cells simply couldn't meet industrial demands. Coal was out of the question. Hydro dams were one possibility for England, given the increased rainfall. But the country's chronic land shortage all but ruled them out. Tidal barrages were a viable option, but they were big. Their construction time could be anything up to a decade. England needed the electricity now. Peterborough had its eddy turbines in addition to its quota from the beleaguered national commerce grid, but even that fell well below the level demanded by Event Horizon, the Combinates, and the plethora of smaller light engineering companies nesting in the suburbs. Eleanor couldn't think how Julia intended to power the tower and cyber precincts she was beginning out at Pryor's Fen. It couldn't be fusion. The Jet 5 reactor at Culham had passed the break-even point a year ago, but commercial applications were still 7 or 8 years away, and looked like being at least as expensive as fission. Perhaps Julia was planning to ship it in using old oil tankers converted to carry giga-conductor cells. They could be charged up in equatorial ports. The power would be there if she spread a few 100 square kilometres of solar cells over the new deserts in Africa and Asia. Her Pryor's Fen project was certainly pitched at that sort of macro scale. The Channel Breakfast newscasts had devoted a lot of time to reports of Julia pouring the first footings of her new headquarters building. Eleanor and Greg had watched it in bed, eating toast and sipping tea, enjoying the quiet period of togetherness, because she damn well knew it would be the only one they'd get today. The traffic began to quicken, her 3 helmeted outriders opening some distance. She drove past the entrance to the Milton Park estate. Normally she used it as a shortcut into Breton, but at this time of day she would have to fight her way through the traffic in the Park Farm industrial precinct, quicker to stick to the trunk road. A comet's tail of red brake lights flared up ahead. Breton was a hive of construction activity, neglected through the PSP decade as the vivacious new developments flourished in what had once been the Green Belt, It was now back in demand with property developers, despite its strategically disadvantaged position sitting between Mucklands Wood and Walton. Housing and industrial units tussled for space in old parklands. Streets were parking yards for the lorries of various building contractors. Eleanor parked behind a low loader carrying a pair of factory-new dumper carts. The first thing she missed were the children. Breton used to be swarming with them. Rounded up and carted off to school, most likely. And a good thing, too. There was so much catching up to do. The one thing she always regretted was not having a formal education. All the kibbutz had given her was the basic reading, writing, arithmetic, and databasing lessons. Then they put her straight into animal husbandry courses. She had enjoyed them, at the time, because it meant that for 3 nights a week she went into Oakham to the sixth form college. 2 hours just sitting down and not having to work. Heaven. The adult courses, or at least getting out of the kibbutz and seeing there were alternative ways to live, had planted the seeds of rebellion, which ultimately resulted in meeting Greg that night 2 years ago. She knew all she needed to run the groves with Greg, although she still toyed with the idea of going back and picking up some more qualifications. One of those warm, misty daydreams which helped life slip down a little easier. A what-if, which was slightly more than idle fantasy. Now, of course, education for children was a new conservative priority, and a real one, not just a manifesto declaration. One of the reasons for the current bout of inflation was the amount of money the Treasury had to print to pay for repairing schools and providing them with up-to-date equipment. So Julia always said. But then it was Julia who was so insistent that total education be implemented as soon as possible. Only because she needs computer literates to work in her cyber factories. And what Julia wanted, Marchant granted. So went the opposition chant. And why am I being so cynical this morning?
You were dead 10 paces ago,
a gravelly female voice said in her ear. Eleanor turned. It was Susie. The Trinity's girl only came up to the base of Eleanor's neck. She was slim to the point of androgyny, with spiked purple hair and a bony face. She wore a pair of tight black jeans and a brown singlet under a new leather biker jacket, which had the Trinity symbol stamped on the right breast. A fist closed round a thorn cross, drops of blood falling. Her age was impossible to pin down, though Greg said she was in her mid-20s. In a girly summer frock, she could have passed for 15. She was grinning up at Eleanor. "I saw you skulking about as soon as I got out of the Ranger," Eleanor said, making it as condescending as possible. "I just didn't want to hurt your ego, that's all."
"Bollocks!"
Eleanor laughed, and scrupulously refrained from ruffling Susie's hair. For all her butch swagger, Susie could get very touchy about her lack of centimetres. She had met the Trinity's girl back when Greg took his first Event Horizon case. It was her first, and please God last, experience of hardlining. Both of them had been hurt during the mission, although Susie had suffered by far the worst injuries. Eleanor still wasn't quite sure if they were friends. Susie had a very frugal social behaviour pattern. Relationship wasn't a word or concept which featured heavily in an urban predator's mental lexicon. But there was certainly a degree of respect, which was a big step. Non-urban predators were universally regarded with complete contempt. "What have you come for?" Susie asked as they walked up the slope towards the Mucklands Wood estate. "I need to have a rap with Royan."
"Yeah?"
Eleanor grinned at the blatant curiosity. "Greg's working on a case again."
"No shit. I thought you weren't going to let him do that again."
"I wasn't, but Julia asked him to." Susie chuckled delightedly.
"Christ, that girl bypasses their brains and plugs directly into their balls. What's she got that I haven't?"
£10 trillion and a medieval virgin princess's hairstyle. They laughed together. As they approached the housing estate, Susie drew a large Luger Mazer pistol from a shoulder holster, carrying it quite openly. Mucklands Wood always reminded Eleanor of old Soviet-style cities in the last century. It was a cultural and architectural throwback to prudent realism, low-cost council housing, the PSP's contribution to the refugee crisis, a magnet for the underclass who couldn't hope to get into one of the overseas-funded projects. Rich with the nutrients that bred resentment, the starkness and dejection of lives condemned to the dole. 15 identical tower blocks, 20 stories high, sheer concrete walls hidden beneath a scale of cheap, low-efficiency solar panels. Crushed limestone covered the ground around them, sticky with a tar of mud. Weeds and nettles grew in defiant clumps, the only vegetation. A few small single-story workshops had been built by the council, earmarked for PSP skill training projects. But they were all empty shells, burnt out, breeze-block walls already alarmingly concave. Another couple of years would see entropy and vandalism reduce them to rubble. Eleanor always hated coming to Mucklands. It infected aspirations and dignity like a cancer. You could never rise out of Mucklands. You could only fight. The Trinities exploited that ruthlessly. She caught glimpses of people lurking among the workshops, walking between the towers. All urban predator types, leather jeans, camouflage jackets, and AK carbines. Even though she had a Trinity's card, she always called in advance, waited until there was someone to escort her in.
"Do the kids here go to school?" she asked Susie.
"Yeah, Father makes sure they do. It's a pain. Some of them make good scouts. Who's going to suspect a 9-year-old?
You'll cope."
Susie gave her a glum look.
"I know what you're thinking. Get them out, fill them with smarts, break the poverty cycle."
"That's right."
"Brilliant. Then who's going to carry on the fight?"
The fight against their nemesis, the Blackshirts, was everything for the Trinities, the reason for their existence. Blackshirts were the remnants of the People's Constables, with whom they had fought a running war for nearly a decade along Peterborough's cluttered, frantic streets. And the two were still fighting as if nothing had changed, as if the PSP was still in power. There were too many dead, too many old scores to settle.
"You can't fight forever," Eleanor said, knowing it was a waste of time.
Trinities lived for combat, lived for death. It was sequenced into their genes now, unbreakable.
"Try me,"
Susie growled dangerously. Two guards stood outside the tower's door, saluting sharply as Susie walked through. Eleanor didn't even feel a reflex laugh coming on. It was too sad. The inside of the tower was kept meticulously clean, a sharp contrast to the external atrophy. Susie knocked once on the door of the old warden's flat and went straight in. The far end of the room was lined with dilapidated metal desks, supporting a range of communication gear. Six Trinities, all girls, were operating the systems. Seven flat screens were fixed to the wall above them, showing images fed from cameras which had to be perched on the top of the towers. Five of them displayed a panoramic view of Mucklands Wood, scanning slowly, while the remaining two were zoomed in on Walton, 2 kilometres away on the other side of the A15, a dense conurbation of rooftops and chimneys, interspaced with the tapering tops of evergreen pines. The quagmire of the Fens Basin was just visible in the background, a grubby brown plain vanishing into the distorted haze line which occluded the horizon. Walton was to the Blackshirts what Mucklands was to the Trinities. Headquarters, barracks, recruiting ground, armory, police and public no-go zone. Both areas were resented by the rest of the city. Even the reserve of gratitude people felt for the Trinities, in their role as focal point for local opposition to the PSP, had withered to nothing over the last 4 years. Peterborough's residents wanted the guerrilla war stopped, wanted to be rid of the urban predators, wanted to get on with their lives without the constant threat of violence and anarchy hovering in the background. The City Council was already talking of implementing a clampdown, maybe even sending in the army to flush Mucklands and Walton clean of undesirables. Eleanor knew it would never end that way. You couldn't drive the Trinities and Blackshirts any further underground. Long before any clean-out operation finished the bureaucracy-stultified preparation phase, the two of them would have it out, head-to-head, straight on, putting everything they'd got into one final hard-line strike. The communication gear operatives were emitting a constant murmur as they talked into their throat mics, occasionally switching the flat screens to different cameras. It looked like a very professional operation. The instigator of it all sat at a desk behind the operator's command position, Teddy Lacroix, an ex-English army sergeant whom the Trinities had named Father, swivelled round in his chair and grinned broadly. He seemed to get bigger each time she met him, easily 2 metres tall, with at least 2/3 of his body weight made up from muscle, probably more. She couldn't imagine anything as soft and vulnerable as human organs being a part of Teddy's makeup. Bioloom light glinted dully on the dark ebony skin of his bald scalp. He was dressed in his usual combat fatigues, cleaned and ironed as though they had only been out of the laundry for an hour. Boa constrictor arms circled round her, and he gave her a hug, kissing her cheek.
"Goddamn girl, you finally did it. You left him and ran away to me,"
"Stop it," she giggled, and slapped at his shoulder. "I'm legally hitched to him till death do us part. You were at the wedding, so behave yourself."
He gave a theatrical sigh and put her down. "You're looking good, Eleanor."
"Thanks."
They stood and looked at each other for a long moment. Teddy was one of Greg's oldest friends. They had both served together back in Turkey. She had been secretly thrilled at gaining Teddy's trust. Approval like that came hard, but it brought her orbit just that fraction closer to Greg's.
"What's that?"
She pointed to his left hand. It was covered in a thin, flexible foam of blue dermal seal. "Bit of extra parliamentary action couple of days back. Nothing bad." Eleanor heard Susie's soft snort. She could guess just how fierce it had been.
"Oh, Teddy."
He rolled his eyes. Yeah, I know. I'll be careful."
"That'll be the day."
He put his arm round her shoulder and walked to the back of the room, away from the communications operators. "Tell me something. You're here to see Royan, right?"
"Yes."
"Special visit, coming by yourself.
This some sort of deal Greg's working on."
He sat on the edge of a wooden table, covered in maps and thick folders, resting his buttocks on the edge. The legs let out little creaks of stress.
"Yes."
Teddy's expression turned serious, forbidding.
"He's out of that, gal. He's got the farm, he's got you. You got a job now, you gotta keep him out. He's made it, clean free, out all this shit."
She put a hand on his forearm.
"No hardlining, Teddy. I wouldn't let him do that again, you know I wouldn't. This is just a case for Julia. It's puzzling, and it's ever so slightly bloody weird, but it's nothing physical, okay?"
Teddy worried at his front teeth with a fingernail.
"Julia?"
The tone was indecisive.
"Yes. She needs his esper sense."
"There's other psychics. This themed shit they're shoveling out these days."
"Name one as good as Greg."
"Yeah," he growled. "Well, you tell that rich bitch from me, it's her ass if anything happens to Greg."
His eyebrows lifted in emphasis.
"Or you."
She stood on tiptoes and planted a kiss on his forehead.
"You're gorgeous."
"Jesus, shit."
Was he actually blushing?
"What is this fucking case anyway? Got to be heavy-duty shit for her to ask in the first place. Last time we rapped, she's as hot as me for Greg to quit."
"Edward Kitchener. She needs to know who killed him."
"The physics guy? Why?"
"He was working on something for her."
She put her hands up in surrender.
"Don't ask me what. I don't understand a word of it."
"Yeah, well, I can see why you need to rap with son. Crap like that, right up his alley. Now don't you go tie up all his capacity. We need him too, more than ever right now."
Her lips turned down.
"Teddy."
"No choice, gal."
He waved at the two screens covering Walton.
"Fucking parties crawling like ants down there. Someone got a stump on 'em. Don't see no police doing it. Or this new fucking wonder government we got lumbered with. You ask Julia, you don't believe me. 3 of her factories hit by thermal bombs this month. Not 5 clicks from here."
She nodded weakly. Trinities and black shirts. It was all a far more deadly version of the apparatchiks and inquisitors game. A game with no rules, nor time limit, nor physical boundary. She knew from bitter experience that it wasn't something which could be solved by police, the due process of law. Greg's last Event Horizon case had shown her that. In that respect, the world terrified her. There was too much subterranean activity, too much hidden from public view. Dark circuitry wiring subliminal power shifts. Ignorance could be a blissful thing, almost enviable. He patted her gently.
"Don't you fret so, gal. You ain't got the face for it. Now then, been too long. You gotta stop by more often."
"You know where the farm is, Teddy. I'd like you to come and see it sometime. Stay over for a few nights. You know how much Greg would love that."
"Turtle out of its shell, gal."
He glanced about the room, taking his time, as if he hadn't seen it for a while, checking to see that everything was in its proper place.
"Sides, won't be here much longer."
His voice dropped to a doleful whisper.
"Not long now. I can feel it coming, gal, like summer heat. Ain't nobody got no respect for the Trinities no more. Time was you could walk down any street in this town and you'd get treated like a superhero. Well, that time's over now. But we know what we gotta do before we go. Bibles in hand, AKs primed, yes, sir. We ain't gonna turn tail now. Gonna finish what we started. Gonna finish those card-carrying sons of bitches. Gonna finish them, but good.
I'll give this a miss, Susie said when the lift opened on the tower's top floor.
There's nothing that ultra-hush about it, Eleanor protested.
Nah, it's all right. I'll be downstairs when you want out. She pressed the button for the ground floor, forcing Eleanor to hop out.
The lift doors slid shut, cutting off Susie's wave and wolfish grin, and any chance to argue. Eleanor thought she knew the real reason. Julia's Austrian clinic had been good, repairing all the physical damage both of them had suffered, but the memories of its infliction were hard to suppress. Royan could act as an all-too-potent reminder. The corridor was narrow, windowless. A long, ceiling-mounted bioloom strip, with an emission decaying into the green edge of the spectrum, lit her way. She stopped outside 206 and knocked. Coy opened the door. A 15-year-old Oriental girl in a blue silk robe. She bowed, deeply.
"Pleasure to see you again, Miss Eleanor."
Her voice was high-pitched and scratchy. Eleanor followed her into the tiny hall, as always slightly uncomfortable at Royan's combination nurse and guardian angel. The door to the lounge slid open, and Coy ushered her through, doll-like face, smiling politely. The air was hot, saturated with a smell of vegetation that was almost fungal. A dozen braids of flower perfume clotted together. Long plant troughs were laid out on the floor, hosting a fabulous collection of flowers, vivid primary colours shining under the glare of the ceiling's Solaris spots. Little wheeled robots roamed among them. They looked as if they had been cobbled together out of a dozen different cybertoy kits by someone working from a very distant memory of a cartoon channel mechanoid. Forks, copper watering roses, and secateurs protruded with no sense of rationale. One wall was completely obscured by the glass bricks of ancient television screens, removed from their cases and bolted into a grid of metal struts. They were all switched on, showing a multitude of channel casts and data sheets. A broad workbench was piled high with gear modules, parts of gear modules, individual components, circuit boards, pieces of mechanical junk. Two big Waldo arms stood silent sentry duty at each end. A camera on an aluminium tripod followed her cautious steps round the troughs. It acted as Royan's eyes, fibre-optic cable plugged into the black modem balls in his eye sockets. He was sitting on a metallic green 1950s dentist chair in the centre of the room. Sitting wasn't quite the right word. Propped up, wedged in by cushions. Royan had no legs or arms. Plastic cups covered the end of each stump. Axon splices, trailing more fibre-optic cables to banks of ware cabinets next to the bench. His torso was covered by a white T-shirt spotted with food stains down the front. Greg had told her Royan was a victim of the People's Constables, a street riot years ago. He'd been there the night it happened, although he never went into details. Despite his youth and agility, Royan just hadn't been fast enough to escape the bullwhips of the constables as they charged the protesters. He had been badly burnt, too, in the cascade of Molotovs which followed. Every time she came, she thought she'd be immune to the sight of him, exposure building up a protective crust around her emotions. Every time he affected her just as badly as the first. Coldness flickered through her, dendritic frost fingers twisting up her stomach. The images and data sheets on the old television tubes vanished, replaced by meter-high green letters which moved right to left across the wall, delineation frequently interrupted by the individual screen rims. "Hi, Eleanor, you look lovely, lovely, lovely today."
"Hello, flatterer. What have you been up to, then?" She spoke fairly loud, trying not to make it obvious. Slow, clear words always made her think of the way people address the retarded.
Royan was anything but. His audio nerves were about the only genuine sensory input he retained. Everything else was electronic, enhanced by the modules he had gradually cocooned himself in. Gear had become his interest, his obsession, his speciality. His comprehension of wear systems was probably equivalent, to a degree, Greg reckoned, maybe even better. His hands-on experience was total. He had to learn simply to survive, and he had nothing else to do but learn, sit passively and absorb the bytes flowing through the country's data nets, day after day after day. And once he had mastered his art, he returned to the fray with a vengeance, fueled by a cold, malevolent hatred whose compulsive power only Greg could fully perceive. He became son to the other Trinities, their digital oracle, a passive presence backing up each campaign with the smartest intelligence data, tracking Blackshirt positions and strength through every memory core in the city and beyond, exposing them wherever they were hiding. Been out dancing, surfboarding, cycling, the usual.
"I brought you these," she said, and pulled the envelope of seeds out of her jeans pocket. "They're orchids, Ludicia discola. They've got red leaves and a white flower. I think you'll like them."
His lips parted to reveal a few bucked yellow teeth. "Thanks, thanks, thanks." Coy stepped forwards and took the envelope, bowing slightly. Greg always brought bits and pieces of gear for him, but she preferred cuttings or seeds. He went to a lot of trouble nurturing his little garden. There wasn't an unhealthy plant anywhere. After Coy disappeared into the kitchen, Eleanor ducked round a hanging basket of pink begonias and sat herself in a plain oak admiral's chair.
"Coffee?" "Please."
It was part of the visit ritual. One of the robots trundled over, a pot of coffee resting on its flat top. She poured herself a cup. It tasted perfect.
"You look tired." "I've been working."
More disapproval slipped into her tone than she intended. "On the farm?"
"No. Mandel Investigations got hauled out on a case."
"Julia, Julia, Julia. Has to be. Greg wouldn't do it for anyone else."
"You've been peeping."
"No. I know you all too well. My friends, I watched Julia on the channels this morning, a billionaireess pouring concrete. Funny, funny, funny. I watch her every day, you know. She's never off."
"No. She could make another fortune if she charged the newscast programs an appearance fee."
"She's pretty, 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 just like you. Lucky, lucky, lucky me. Two prettiest girls in the country are my friends." She took another sip, surprised to find herself relaxing.
"Aren't you going to ask me why I'm here?"
she asked, slyly. "I know why. He wants something, so he sent you. He knows I'm a sucker, sucker, sucker for a beautiful girl. I am, too.
We had to split up, actually. There's a lot of ground to cover today."
"What's the case?"
"The Kitchener murder."
She started giving him a review of the data they'd amassed. As far as she could tell, he was listening attentively. Certainly the vaguely eerie lettering faded from the screens, a sure sign of contemplation. The session wasn't turning out as emotionally arduous as she had been expecting. The trick was to block out the rest of his life, the daily horror of eating, crapping, peeing, the pain spasms which convulsed him every few hours. Pretend everything stopped when she wasn't there. That all he did was meet visitors who brought him gossip and problems he could gain a measure of satisfaction from solving. It was weak of her to think like that, craven, but it was the only way she could get through. The suffering he went through was a tragedy on an epic scale. If it wasn't the students, and it wasn't a Tech-Merc snuff deal, then who done it?
Good question. I didn't say a Tech-Merc definitely wasn't involved, but they certainly didn't drive in, and they didn't fly in, either.
Of course, we're not ruling out the possibility that someone yomped in, but Greg says he doesn't think it's likely. If he says it didn't happen, it didn't.
He says he's not sure.
Royan's rucked smile appeared again. What do you think?
I think it would have been absolutely impossible for anyone to walk in and out of the Cheetah Valley that evening. It was bad enough driving our EMC Ranger in yesterday. Lawnd Abbey is very isolated.
I believe you. What do you want me to do?
She put down the empty coffee cup and held up her cyberfax. I've brought the schematics for the Abbey's security system. I need to know if it's possible for someone to burn through, enter the Abbey, and then get out again afterwards without raising the alarm. The police forensic teams say it was completely undisturbed.
One of the wear modules on the top of the bench let out a small bleep. When she turned, blue and green LEDs were winking on the front of the scuffed grey plastic casing.
Squirt, the bite's over. No problem for me.
She pointed the cyberfax at the module and keyed a squirt.
Got it. I'll start looking for a way through. Should have an answer by this afternoon.
Fine.
Eleanor slipped the cyberfax into her back pocket.
Can you also find out if any hot rod was contracted to supply this hypothetical burn virus?
I'll ask. Might not get 100% accurate answer. If it was done, the writer won't be advertising.
Have you heard of anyone asking for a virus like this?
No. Cross heart. OK, final point. Greg thinks it would be useful to know what sort of rumours are floating about. Ask around the circuit. Find out what people think Kitchener was working on for Julia. Whether they even knew he was working for Julia. And also, did Kitchener owe money to anyone? He was a millionaire, multi. He was a regular syntho user, and so were some of the students. He had his own vat at Laund, but the basic compounds still cost money, so it probably wouldn't be banks we're talking about. Gotcha. Kitchener used syntho? Yes. Man like that. Wow, wow, wow. She gave him a sad smile. Yes, a man like that. Funny old world, isn't it? You wouldn't think he'd need it, a brain like his. Maybe because he had a brain like that. Nobody on this planet was his equal. Maybe he was lonely, lonely, lonely. Oh, no, not Kitchener, not lonely. One of the girl's students is having his child. There was no answer for a moment. The last lonely remained splashed across the three right-hand screens. Then the word evaporated like morning dew. She heard the lens on the camera whirring softly, zooming in on her face. He was old. 67, I think. All that time, so many years. He accomplished an awful lot, she said, uncertain where Royan was leading. Not true. At the back of her mind, she knew exactly. She just didn't want to acknowledge it. Do you like me, Eleanor? That grin didn't have to be forced. I keep coming back, don't I? Yes, 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 thank you. She stood up, straightening the creases out of her sweatshirt. Now don't spend all your time working on the Abbey security system. Teddy says he needs you for Trinity's work. Bugger him, pardon my French. I decide my own priorities. Me, me, me. You'll get me into trouble. Never. Say hi to Greg. Tell him he had better show up himself next time.
I will.
And you. Come back. See me.
Yes.
She gave him a last glance, non-human, shamed by the fact that she could never in a million years show so much bravery. There was no point in even asking him to come out to the farm. It could be done, physically, with stretchers and vans and plenty of advanced planning, but his inheritance tied him to Mucklands far tighter than the web of fibre-optic cables ever did. Him and Teddy, neither of them would leave. There was no point. They were Mucklands. It went with them wherever they were. Coy popped up out of the kitchen without being summoned, and showed her to the door.